You are listening to the podcast That's Life in Sweden, or as we say in Swedish, Sånt är livet i Sverige, with me, your host, Lisa Orsimäki. Today I welcome Professor Arnold Pierce, who is the head of the Department of Learning and Engineering Sciences at Stockholm's Royal Institute of Technology, or as it's called in Swedish, Kungliga Tekniska Högskolan. Welcome to the program, Arnold.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed. It's a pleasure to be contacted in this way. Thank you for the interest.
To start off with, can you talk about a little bit about your background and particularly what attracted you to technology and engineering, and then the transition you made to teach in the areas?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So I guess that story begins quite a long time ago, actually, in the 1980s. When I finished high school in Australia, as you can tell from my accent, I'm not a native Swede. So in the 80s there, it was very popular to study science and technology. And my parents, one parent is a language teacher and the other parent is a biology teacher in the upper secondary school in Australia. And so I was strongly encouraged by my parents to pursue a science and technology career. So I enrolled at university and thought initially that I'd become a space physicist. I guess, you know, those types of dreams that you have when you're a kid. But I very quickly discovered that I was very attracted to the creative side of computer programming. Mm-hmm. And I'd in fact been working with that as an interest even as a child. So I built my first computer from a kit that I bought from the US when I was about 14 years old and taught myself to program in assembly language. And then I just went on to follow that interest. So that led to me ultimately taking a PhD in computer architecture in Australia at La Trobe University in Melbourne in 1992. And then I was thrown into the classroom, teaching very large courses, introductory programming with 500-600 students in these huge lecture theatres. And I really started to think about, you know, what's the pedagogy here? How are we going about teaching and learning, and reflecting on my own experience as a student, thinking, can this be done better? And so I became very interested in the early research that was being done, particularly actually in Australia and Sweden. So this work of Roger Selye and Ferenc Martin and Gothenburg, in fact, people that you're probably very familiar with. Early work on deep and surface learning. So it happened that the person who was the director of the higher education learning unit at La Trobe University was Michael Prosser at the time. And so I came into contact with Michael, and through Michael, a number of other prominent sort of names in the higher education teaching and learning scene. And I was looking to leave Australia. I sort of had realised that if I was going to make a successful academic career, I needed to get outside of my own country, outside the university where I'd taken my own PhD. And so actually I was working in France in 1996 and 1998 and spent quite a bit of time learning French in order to take a scholarship or an academic exchange program to work in France. And then I met my wife, who's Swedish, sort of by fluke. And so then it became very interesting to move to Sweden. And I sort of figured that, you know, if I could learn French, well, Swedish couldn't be that hard to learn either. Well, I wasn't quite right there. It's not completely trivial to learn Swedish, but, you know. So then I moved to Sweden, and that was also in some sense pure serendipity. It turned out that I knew the director of education at the Department of Computer Systems in Uppsala because he'd been on exchange to my university in Australia when I was a PhD student. So I reached out to him and he said, absolutely, you know, I remember you from when you were a student. This is great. Come to Uppsala. We'll fix you up with guest teaching position. And then after a few years, a permanent position opened up and I could take that. And then I stayed there. But I guess my continuing interest besides the sort of technical computer science aspect has always been teaching and learning. How can I work systematically to improve the student experience?
Yes. And you know, that brings me to the next question, because one of the challenges with STEM subjects is to actually attract students, and especially females. What do you do? What's your advice, or what do you do to attract young students to study STEM?
So it's a complex question, of course, as you're well aware. I'm not sure it's about attracting people. I think it's more, as Louise Archer would say in the UK, I don't know if you followed her Aspires project that tracks young people through their school experiences into university, and now it's following people into their early career lives. And a lot of those stories that are heard there are not so much one of attraction, but of exclusion, systematic exclusion from access to valid identities. And so there are a lot of people who are systematically excluded. It's not just women, it's different minorities, it's people who think in different ways, it's people with particular types of interests that are not perceived and reinforced in their learning environment as being sufficiently sciencey for you to feel that you yourself are at home in that discipline, that you have a place there, that you're a valid part of that activity. And I think it's this subtle exclusion that we really need to work more systematically with. And also looking at how does education create opportunities for people to define a viable identity for themselves within the context of these STEM disciplines. What does it mean to be a STEM person? How can we broaden those types of definitions to include more people with more types of background and experience that can be of enormous value to us? I mean, we're quite aware from other research, especially management research, that diversity tends to lead to higher quality decision making in industry settings, in policy settings. And it also helped us to represent our society and the mix of our society better in these decision-making processes. So when it comes to attracting more individuals, I think it's about creating opportunities for individuals. And there I think we need to be very aware of and analyse the messages, the tacit and the reproduced in society patterns that have a tendency to exclude. So I have, for instance, a PhD student who's working at the moment looking at the images that technology gymnasiums in Sweden use to advertise their programs. And it's quite clear from a comparative analysis there that the types of images that are used are typically technology and artifact focused. They're not social in nature. They don't deal with the societal context. All of these markers that we know have a tendency to make an area less attractive to women, for instance. So just in this subliminal messaging in what you see when you surf into a website for a technology program in Sweden, you're already seeing signals that say this is not something that perhaps is particularly attractive to young women.
Here in Sweden, we talk about inclusion. We talk about a school for all. And what you are actually saying is that, well, it's not really quite...
Well, I don't think we're there yet. I think, you know, of course, it's a part of Swedish culture to be self-critical and to, in a sense, be a bit of a Sweden basher yourself, that to think that, you know, we could always be better, that we're not doing this very well. I think we are doing it much better than many other countries. I think awareness is the first step towards empowerment. And the fact that we're aware of these problems, that we actively have programs that are designed to deal with them. I'm working in a strategic group at the very top level of KTH right at the moment, looking at broadened recruitment and broadened participation. How should we as a university work more systematically with that? How could we provide opportunities for people with different types of ways of learning, or if you come into the environment with dyslexia or with some other type of learning challenge. Yeah, exactly. So that you're in this position where our system is not designed to support your learning well. How can we be more socially and societally aware of this and help to create those platforms for a sort of social justice perspective on access to higher education?
Sustainability education into teaching engineering and making technology and engineering, if you like, more meaningful?
My department delivers the teacher education programs at KTHS. So not just the teacher education for the primary school, but also staff training programs for university teachers. So we're working very intensively in both research and innovation there, and also in teaching courses that inform our academic colleagues and try to scaffold an understanding of how to integrate these types of concepts into teaching in all disciplines. I think there's been a tendency to take both sustainable development and also some elements of ethics and some social competencies, intercultural competence, languages, and think of these as being peripheral to engineering, that engineering is very much about technical problem solving. But I think we're increasingly aware of the fact that solving large-scale societal challenges, climate change and so forth, is going to require another type of approach. And we see this also in the political dialogue surrounding these challenges. So what we try to do is raise awareness amongst our colleagues. And we have both interest groups, so we have these sort of priority groups within KTH who actively collect people who are interested in different types of pedagogical questions, who meet in a collegial environment with some scaffolding from our department. We also are very active in conducting research into these areas. You know, what does international higher education research and development literature tell us about how to approach this most effectively? Can American research be used in the Swedish context? How do we raise awareness amongst our students? Because also the student voice is very strong in Sweden. So if students are asking, how is this integrated? Universities in Sweden are much more likely to respond, and I think to respond in a constructive way. So we're sort of working in those dimensions. We have sort of formal activities, but then, of course, as you would be aware yourself, that these types of in-service academic training programs that exist in universities, they don't reach very far into the collegiate in some sense. Quite often the people who are participating in these activities are the ones who are already interested in improving their teaching and learning. And so some of the people that you might like to reach or you feel perhaps would benefit from some of these insights, often they're so focused on their research or on something else that they're harder to reach than other colleagues.
What do you do in order to try to reach them? What suggestions do you have? Or do you just think, oh, well, let's leave the researchers alone?
No, absolutely not. But I think, again, Sweden is leading the world here in terms of mandating a certain level of professional development before you can be promoted to docent or to professor. So if you look at how that works, anybody entering the Swedish tenure track system has over the course of the first 5 or 6 years of their career to engage with at least 15 ECTS credits of higher education pedagogy material. And this gives them at least some perspective. I actually took our introductory course, 7.5 credit course at KTH last year myself to see what happens nowadays in these courses. And I was very encouraged. The 50 people who took that course in the autumn of last year were very open to new ideas. They were very curious. They were truly interested in student teaching and learning at different levels, of course. But I think I see a real grassroots sort of change there in attitude. I think 20 years ago, these courses were seen to be a barrier to academic promotion and a sort of thing that you did because you had to, but you didn't really believe in it. I think new generations of academics are taking this much more seriously and see the benefits also.
Are there particular competencies and skills in your area that you believe are important? You did mention, you touched on some of these, like, you know, being creative and, you know, how do we meet future climate change needs? But do you have any particular competencies and skills that you believe are absolutely what we need?
I've been a big believer in, and still am a big believer in, interdisciplinarity and in intercultural awareness. I think those types of skills, and we see this also in national reports from the NSF in the US, calls to educate the global engineer, the Academy of Engineering in the UK with its agenda for the engineer of 2021 and 2020 and so forth, looking at how do we equip people to work in a highly agile world where technology is changing extremely rapidly and where a lot of the workplace is actually structured around communication, trying to understand, you know, how do we operate more collectively as a European society rather than perhaps on individual national levels. So I think a lot of these skills are going to be central. And of course, technology is going to provide us with new tools here. So, I mean, we already see the enormous transformation that social media, YouTube, Twitch, Twitter have had on our modes of communication and how that has opened up and in some sense globalized communication, connected people with very esoteric interests more rapidly to each other. And of course, this has both advantages and disadvantages. It also allows some types of hate speech to propagate. It can collect and support and promote some quite poisonous ways of thinking as well. But I think on the average, it's a positive technological innovation. But we really need to spend some time understanding what is happening in terms of these technologies. And I can see that you've got a question coming up for me here that surrounds a very recent technology that's just been released. And these types of technologies are changing our world. Part of my discussion in the webinar the other day was to say that universities have lost control of the information curation space. Universities and university libraries used to be the place that you went to access information, to get input in some sense. Now those inputs are everywhere. They're globalized and distributed. Universities have no control over them. And people are generating this information at exponential rates. So I think the role of a university is no longer to curate and transmit information. It's more to help people to think about how they will integrate and use that information in their working lives. So coming back to your original question, I think one of the things that we need to think quite seriously about is how could we move university education closer to the professional life experience that one expects after university? How do we create more authentic learning environments that increase the relevance of what we do, so that students really can feel that there is a strong connection between what I'm doing right now and the skills and techniques that I'm learning, the mathematical formula, the physics that I'm learning, and how I will need these things as an operating professional further down the line.
There is a fear that technology will take over, if you like, the teacher's work or the role of the teachers. What do you think? Do you think that will happen? And I'm of course thinking now of, which we are going to be talking about the Chat GPT. But what do you think? You know, do you think technology will replace the teacher?
The simple answer to that is no. I don't think that any type of system that's based on statistical analysis of large quantities of data will ever teach other people to think. I mean, we have to be very aware that what these systems do, even if it looks very smart, is essentially cut and paste from existing material. And so, I mean, I'd like to describe Chat GPT like autocorrect or text prediction on your iPhone on steroids, right? It's the same type of technology, just faster and more sophisticated and with access to more data. And so really what we're doing is we feed a huge quantity of data into a statistical network model, and it forms weights and connections. And we tell it that some things are more desirable than others by giving it feedback in a reinforcement phase afterwards. And then we ask it questions, and it determines, based on a statistical model, what stuff is most likely to be the sort of thing that we're looking for and the sort of thing that matches what we're asking for. And then it pulls all of that out and it puts it together in plausible ways. We also know that what these tools do is that they make stuff up. So if you ask it to summarize the research literature in a particular field, some of the references will be made up. And they will seem extremely plausible, and they'll be written by authors who are widely recognized in those domains. But there probably was some gap in the research literature, or you asked a question where there isn't much literature. And so the system is capable of synthesizing from several other already published titles and abstracts something plausible that could have been published somewhere, that also helps to support perhaps an argument that you've asked it to construct. But again, coming back, will these technologies replace the teacher? Absolutely not. In the same way that the printing press didn't replace the teacher, that television didn't replace the teacher, that radio didn't replace the teacher. The technology in itself is in some sense a super Encyclopedia Britannica combined with a smart search function. So it can aggregate things for you, it can summarize, it can do many things that are time-consuming much more efficiently than we can do them today. But it doesn't replace the type of intellectual thinking and approach that participation in an academic community teaches you. And you only need to spend half an hour in a dinner conversation with somebody from another university environment to recognize that they have a university training. It comes through in the manner in which they construct arguments, in the ways that they use evidence to support reasoning, also in their attitude to being contradicted, to being challenged. How do they respond to that? And I think those qualities of education are things that technologies will never replace, where in fact the technologies may provide us as teachers with much greater opportunity to use our time very productively with our younger colleagues, developing those types of skills rather than perhaps focusing on the transmission of factual information, which can be garnered in other ways.
So what advice do you have for university educators on how to handle artificial intelligence and ChatGPT? If you have one or two pieces of advice, what would they be?
So I think there's a crucial observation and then a piece of advice. I think my crucial observation is that what these tools do is they break the link between a product and a process. And in academia, we have asked students to write essays, we've asked them to write code, we've asked them to produce reports, we've asked them to do many things that ultimately are graded based on the characteristics of the product, assuming that the characteristics of the product are the result of the process. In many of these situations now, you can achieve the result without engaging with the process at all, because the technology can give you the product. So in that situation, I think we need to realize that we can no longer judge student learning by looking at the final result of a process. Rather, we have to look at the process itself. And I guess that comes down to my piece of advice, which is I think that we need to really think very seriously about what is it that we really value in terms of student learning, and how could we observe that in ways that would help us to understand that students really are achieving what we are setting out to achieve, but also make it very obvious to them how relevant this is to their own personal growth and to their future success. And I think part of the key to that also is to try to think more deeply about how do we structure our teaching and learning environments? And again, getting back to this idea of authenticity, what is an authentic experience? What is a student co-created experience? If I understand, for instance, in computer programming, what I would like a student to engage with, but then actually I can provide them with those parameters and say, pitch me a project idea that uses these technologies to create something that you yourself are interested in. Complete game changer. When I created the problem and told them, go away and solve this problem, I want you to write a piece of code that does exactly this, then they're solving my problem. They're not working as entrepreneurs or as innovators with their own ideas. They're working with my ideas. And I think if we can turn that around and help to increase the relevance of education by helping students to work with their own ideas, then these tools become a non-threat. The other observation is that these tools are not going away and they're developing quite rapidly. So forbidding them, trying to detect them, I think is a losing game. I think we need to understand also how they will be used in people's professions in the future. For instance, again, taking my own discipline, computer science, I don't think that computer programmers are going to write routine code for very much longer. I think that these engines will be able to generate routine code quite reliably in the short term. And then the role of the computer science person is going to be much more related to actually what computer science is really all about, understanding the role of computing systems and what computing systems can achieve for people in realistic settings, rather than our fallacy that we've had for many years or been combating for many years, that computer science is about coding, it's about writing programs. Actually, it's not. It's about thinking about how to solve challenges in ways that are productive, but rely on computation. And we see now the result of this also. These systems solve problems that we thought were insoluble 20 years ago. Why? Because computers are so much faster. And so what was intractable 20 years ago is now computable. And so we can build these huge models and we can process them in real time, which we couldn't do a decade ago.
You are also involved in a university network for innovation, technology and engineering, or UNITE. Can you talk about the significance of this network?
So this is a network of 9 technical universities across Europe, and it's part of the larger Erasmus Plus initiative to establish a European network of universities, or a number of these networks of universities, with the goal of trying to understand how to leverage European competence to deliver higher quality to learners within the European Union. And I find it exciting because I think it offers us opportunities to help our students with just the things I was talking about earlier: authenticity, understanding how to solve problems in multicultural and multidisciplinary contexts. By leveraging these networks, you gain access to different educational cultures, to cutting-edge competence and expertise and research and innovation that is different in the different universities. KTH is very good at something, but not at everything. If you want to really experience top-level innovation or research in an area where KTH is perhaps not leading the world, then perhaps Aalto or Darmstadt or University of Lisbon, the Polytechnic in Catalonia, one of these universities can offer you something that you can't get as a student at KTH. And I think that these types of visions for Europe also have long-term impact and implications for the development of a socially just and democratic Europe. Increasing understanding between countries and student populations, equipping future generations with the tools and techniques that they need really to combat the global challenges, perhaps. Of course, it's one attempt of many to make a difference, and we'll see where it leads, but I think it has some exciting potential. And I think also that, I mean, whilst we can see both the constructive and the destructive side of these technologies, it's quite clear that disinformation campaigns are hard to sustain in the modern world unless you can create social media bubbles which people don't leave. And of course, this is something that has been a subject of controversy, particularly with the social engineering that was associated with Brexit, for instance. Using social media platforms to influence voter populations. We've probably also seen that recently in the US. And then, of course, it allows other countries also to interfere with other countries' democratic processes. So I think, you know, we need to be very aware of this. And, you know, if you follow the sustainability argument as well, it surprises me sometimes that we focus very much on things that are easy to see when it comes to sustainable development. We focus on fossil fuel vehicles. We focus on air travel. We focus perhaps on brown coal electricity generation. But we don't actually focus on what the internet costs us in terms of the environment. I don't think I've seen much discussion of that at all. Maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I have. That's you are absolutely right. Now that you said it, I thought, no, there hasn't been any discussion about the cost of internet.
There's some quite interesting recent publications that show that if information storage, digital information storage, grows at current rates over the next 20 years, then just keeping the world's data alive will consume nearly all of the world's available electricity supply. So you can ask yourself then, how much of this data do we really need? and which bits of it should we be switching off. Again, YouTube, how much of the content on YouTube actually has an intellectual value? A lot of it is self-promotion. Every time you send a Snapchat to somebody, you're sending a high-resolution digital image. The cost of that transmission of that image to the environment is not negligible, not completely negligible. And if enough people are doing it, of course, it's consuming enormous amounts of power. If we turn back to ChatGPT, just the training of these generative AI models can cost enormous amounts of electrical power. So probably a ChatGPT deployment, it could cost a month of electricity supply for an area the size of California, for instance.
Wow, that's sobering.
So you can ask yourself, how often do you want to do this? And then, of course, we have very destructive technologies. Bitcoin is a good example of a technology that consumes electricity with very, very little value. I mean, if you have a Britannica on the shelf, just keep it, because, you know, you might not be using a Dr. Google in 50 years' time.
Is there anything you want to bring up that I haven't sort of mentioned that you think, you know, this is really important?
I think one thing that I'd like to mention just as a closing remark is that the academic profession has a huge responsibility in these times. And I think we need to really shoulder that responsibility and also believe in ourselves and our professionalism when it comes to assessing and certifying student learning and knowledge. I think there's a bit of a tendency in some of our quality assurance systems to undermine ourselves and to focus on assessing what is easily assessed and what is easily explained. And I think we need to move away from that and challenge ourselves and believe in ourselves so that others also can believe in us.
Do you think people are losing kind of belief in universities and what is happening in universities, or like losing, it's like losing, what do you call it? The sense of, are they doing good things at universities? Because when you mention that we have to stop believing in ourselves a bit more, it sounds like we're losing, this confidence as experts in our areas. What's wrong with that? And how do we change it, I guess?
I think initiatives like this one that you have today are a good start to put us in the public eye, to try to also speak about different topics that are highly relevant. But also, I think your observation, at least in the American context, would be correct, that there is an increasing debate about whether universities provide value in parity to what they cost. And what is the value of an education? I think that type of very utilitarian analysis and approach to universities is ultimately failing to understand the true value of the university and the academic system in general. There's a reason why also academic systems do not change rapidly. And part of that is also a very good idea that there are some fundamental principles and some ways of thinking and some ways of conducting higher education that are really worth preserving. And as we move into this highly technological future, we need to really think about what the campus universities do. Why do they have campuses? And what value does that add that can't be obtained in a digital environment? The digital is very seductive. We perceive it as being lower cost. We perceive it as being of high flexibility, high accessibility. But there are also things that are very bad about these digital environments and will continue to be, I believe. But we need to understand why is it that we need to meet each other, and what is it that in those learning moments that creates academic scholarship. The thing that I'm most active in doing at the moment is working with this concept of computational thinking. What is computational thinking, or datalogistänkande, as it's called in Swedish? How can it be defined? How can it be integrated into both school and general education? So I've written quite a number of articles, both taking up the issues of definition and discussing the problems that can arise if we create too narrow definitions, but then also working with several projects that develop resources for teachers and pupils in schools to deal with these concepts and in new and innovative ways. So I can provide you a couple of links there. That's what I'm working on at the moment.
Thank you so much, Arnold, for your time and generosity in sharing with us your research and perspectives.
All right. Thank you very much.
And you have been listening to the podcast Sånt är livet i Sverige, or in English, That's Life here in Sweden, with me, Lisa Orsimäki. Till next time, take care of yourself and each other. Bye for now.